Right now on the Daily Debrief.
There were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller speaks about his findings.
That allegation deserves the attention of every American.
But what if he's called to testify before Congress? Plus,
it was blow after blow after blow to a child's skull.
Prosecutors say this man killed a business associate and his entire family. The defense accuses the prosecution of flat-out lying.
I'm not giving you the closing like this because it's easier to lie when my back's to you.
Also,
he was penetrating me from behind.
A fourth accuser testifies against a former NFL player accused of sex crimes. And former babysitters testify in favor of a Florida man accused of murdering his five children. Real-life criminal cases are on the Daily Debrief. It's Wednesday, May 29th.
Welcome to the Debrief, everybody. I'm Aaron Keller, along with Linda Kenny Bodden. We have a lot to talk about today. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has spoken, and he will say nothing further, at least nothing of consequence. Today, Mueller took to a DOJ podium to announce he was closing his office and to say any testimony he is ordered to give before Congress will not go beyond the words of his report. Words, he says, were carefully chosen. Mueller was appointed to investigate attempts by Russia to interfere with the 2016 presidential election. Mueller had this to say about whether or not he could have charged President Donald Trump with a crime.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the Volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider. The opinion says that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. And beyond department policy, we were guided by principles of fairness. It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge.
Former federal prosecutor Gene Rossi is a law and crime analyst. He says Congress should force Mueller to testify and go even further by impeaching the president.
What he is saying is Congress, Volume 2, and possibly Volume 1, both have evidence that could be the basis for initiating impeachment proceedings. Do your job. He's also saying this. I could not conclude that he did not commit a crime. With a wink and a nod, he's basically saying, I had enough to charge him, but that memo says I could not.
Joining me early in today's program are Judge Ashley Wilcott and criminal defense attorney Linda Kenny Bodden. So, Judge Wilcott, let me ask you this one. This is a clear kick the can to Congress. Congress, take my words. I'm not going to say much more than that because I put everything in the report. As Gene said, do your job.
No, I completely agree with Gene, and I think that's what they need to do. They need to have him there. They need to have him testify. I don't think that it's sufficient to say it's in my report. Here it is. It would be unfair because he can't go to court if he's charged, and it's unconstitutional. Congress now has it on their plate. They have the ball. They've got to act.
Linda Kenny Bodden, principles of fairness here. Now, Mueller said he didn't want to charge anybody because, well, it couldn't be tried in a court of law. But look, I see prosecutors make accusations all the time of this nature. And look, I mean, even if Mueller went further, the president can talk to millions of people and millions of people would listen to him. So wouldn't this thing, in essence, be tried by an election or some other process?
Right. Because obviously, if he goes into Congress, he said he's not saying anything anymore, and then there'll be executive privilege, in my opinion, asserted, and we're not going to get any further. So it's either going to be tried in a court of public opinion right now as it is, or tried with an impeachment hearing, and he'll be acquitted in the Senate.
This debate will continue, I'm sure. We will move along, though, because testimony has entered its second week in the trial of a former NFL player accused of sex crimes involving five women. Kellen Winslow II played 10 seasons with the Cleveland Browns and other teams. He faces 12 charges, some on your screen in multiple counts. The maximum penalty, if convicted, is life with the chance for parole. Testimony today circled back to the account of Jane Doe number one. That accuser's daughter had these discussions with her mother, the accuser, days after the alleged attack.
She asked me about STD testing, and I let her know that Planned Parenthood, you could do it for free, and it's confidential.
Ms. Foster, when you were having that conversation with her on March 18th, did you see any items of clothing in your mother's bedroom?
On top of the pile of the laundry basket, there was a pair of white pants. They were stained with blood.
Did you see where there was blood on the pants?
It was in the crotch area.
Did you ask your mother about that?
I did, but the way I phrased it was, oh, you ruined your pants. And what she replied was, yeah, I'm on the rag. She had asked me to look up the phone number for the Encinitas Sheriff's Department.
Did you do that for her?
Yes, I did.
Did you ask her why she needed you to look up the phone number for the Encinitas Sheriff's Department?
Yes, at this point, I was a little concerned because of the STD testing mentioned a few days before. So I asked her if everything was okay, and she said, yes, I was attacked, but I'm going to file a police report.
Now back to the accusers. Jane Doe number four says that she was 17 years old when she was attacked by the defendant and by a friend named Matt.
I came, opened my eyes, and my face was being pushed into Matt's groin area.
Where were you when you woke up to that, or when you came to?
Is it a bedroom? On a bed.
Do you remember if that was upstairs or downstairs?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Do you know how you got from the couch to the bedroom being on a bed?
No.
What was Kellen doing at the time that he was pressing your head towards Matt's groin area?
He was penetrating me from behind.
Was he having sex with you?
Yes.
Was he having sex with you at the time that you regained consciousness?
Yes.
Winslow's accusers are taking the stand in order. Here is a recap of the previous testimony of Jane Doe's 1, 2, and 3.
Jane Doe number 1 is a 54-year-old transient who says Winslow approached her while she was hitchhiking. Then she said he raped her.
I kept on saying, ow, 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 because I don't know how he fit that thing in there.
She went to the police 4 days later.
He's like, no, no way, I'll kill you.
When you told him to pull over and let you out at the hospital, did he say that he would kill you?
Yes, he said that he was going to get this done.
But her story has inconsistencies, including about the source of blood she claimed was the result of a violent rape.
The blood that we're talking about here was from menstruating rather than being penetrated and assaulted, correct?
Yes. Yes, sir.
She also once identified an attorney, not the defendant, as her attacker. The defense says sex occurred, but was consensual. Jane Doe number 2, a 59-year-old homeless woman, said Winslow also raped her.
Tell us what he actually did on the side of the car when you were in the passenger seat.
Well, he had me take my pants off, and pulled me on front of the seat, and, you know, started to rape me.
She said she recognized Winslow because he'd often stop and talk to the homeless.
So you're being choked by two hands.
It was two hands, and I knew he was smart.
What?
Because he did it in the way that you can't leave any marks. Just
what?
The same as him ejaculating outside, sir.
Here, the defense also claims the sex was consensual. 57-year-old Jane Doe number 3 spoke through an interpreter to tell jurors that she lived near Winslow.
I was walking toward the orange tree, and then he was following me. And then he took his pants and then exposed his penis to me.
The encounter happened while she was gardening.
When you saw his penis, was it erect?
Yes.
Did he touch himself?
Yes, he used his hand to hold the penis.
This Jane Doe said she didn't look her attacker in the eye because her culture does not encourage it. She reported the incident to police the day it occurred.
Discuss this case with Judge Ashley Wilcott and defense attorney Linda Kenny Bodden. So Linda, Jane Doe number 4 says the attack came after a previous sex act with the defendant. I hate to ask this, but does that make her story less credible?
Well, you know, I don't think so in this case, Aaron. Having listened to her, she said, look, every woman has a right to say no, and she's absolutely right here that this was non-consensual at that time. At that moment, even, it could be non-consensual. I thought she was very credible, Aaron.
Okay. Linda Kenny Bodden, one accuser left to go here. Are you starting to think that they're just going to add all these up, and despite issues perhaps with Jane Doe number 1's testimony, that the jury will just say, these sound similar enough where I believe them all?
Which one, Aaron? I'm sorry. I didn't know what you were directing that to. So let me just say this. I'll answer for you. I think that's problematic. I think that from the get-go, that's the problem for the defense, is that they just are going to have an uphill battle separating each crime and showing each reasonable doubt for each one. The jury's going to look at it together, I'm afraid.
I agree with that assessment as well. We have we're going to wait and see how testimony rolls along. Jane Doe number 4 still on the stand in this case. Cross-examination with her will resume later today. And so ahead on The Debrief, the defense pushes its insanity theory in the case of a South Carolina man accused of murdering his 5 children one by one. Plus, the state goes for emotion. The defense accuses the state of lying in the death penalty case against a California man accused of murdering a father, a mother, and 2 children. That's after the break here on The Debrief. Accused of murdering his 5 kids is pressing an insanity defense in a South Carolina courtroom. Timothy Jones Jr. could be executed if jurors find him guilty and then agree on a punishment. He admits taking the lives of his children, ages 1 through 8, and then driving around with their bodies in the back of his SUV for more than a week. The defense still has the case and called a Child Protective Services caseworker to testify. The Jones home was filled with religious items when she checked after reports of behavioral problems like these.
Ultimately, I guess he told you something about he and Elias had put a train set together, and I guess Natan had gotten jealous and broke it.
Right, that's what he said. He said that they had worked really hard on this train track, and he said that Natan destroyed it, and that was upsetting to him.
And I guess he told you that he had kind of jerked him up by the collar and spanked him?
Yes, that was the main thing, to get an understanding as to where, you know, the marks had come from. And he never stated that he had choked him. He demonstrated to us that he had jerked him up from by his collar. And he demonstrated this.
A former babysitter, however, testified that Jones was generally a good father who was fair when he disciplined the children.
Did you ever see Tim interact with the kids as far as any type of discipline?
Mm-hmm, I did. As far as the discipline, usually he would just take away things that made him happy, like those ride-on toys. You know, if Tim came to my house and he was upset because of the report card, he would come in and he would pick it up himself and remove it and say, you know, you don't ride that tomorrow. You know, something like that. I mean, he would just take away something that, or like if they were going to go skating on Wednesday, this one wasn't going to skate.
Did you ever see any bruises on the children?
Nope.
Would you have had an opportunity?
I would have.
Was there any point in time that they would be outside during that summer running around in the sprinklers?
Yes, sir. He purchased a slip and slide and a swim pool sprinkler, and they played that summer outside a lot in the backyard at his house, and I was obviously out there with them.
So you would see him without...
Absolutely, in their trunks, and yeah.
Never saw anything that made you have any concern?
No.
Here's the thing, though. The defendant's former girlfriend testified that Jones started to change in February 2013. That's when she says he became more controlling.
Take us through the concerns that you had for the children, Crystal, once you started living in that home.
His discipline. The way he would whip them, you could hear it through the walls. He would take them to the bathroom. The way he made them do exercises and standing on his tippy toes in the corner. He finally moved to that after we argued so much about his discipline actions. He wound up moving to just like exercises, tippy toes in the corner.
And when we talk about excessive, you were actually seeing bruises on the children?
Yes, ma'am. On their back end, on their legs, going down their legs. Of course, they probably was moving because you could hear it through the walls. He was hitting them pretty hard.
And what tone of voice would he be in when he would be disciplining the children?
Very angry. You could tell he was over angry. He should have calmed himself down before he took discipline actions.
When you would hear these things happening, is there anything that the children could do or say to make them stop?
They would ask them to please stop. I could hear it, and I couldn't do nothing about it because every time when I would, me and him would get into it about it, he would say they're his kids, which they were, and it just, it caused a lot of conflict.
And then eventually, was there something that you witnessed with Mira?
Yeah, with her, the bruises down her legs and all, it was her and Natan. I think they were playing around, and Natan busted the window. He didn't mean to, he fell, and he busted the window, and he whipped them pretty hard, and then they had to stay on the corner on their tippy toes all day long.
We will continue to monitor that case. And now to California, where the defense and the state are fighting it out right until the end in the capital murder case against Charles Merritt. He's accused of killing business associate Joseph McStay and the entire McStay family in 2010. All four of the McStays were beaten with a hammer. Their bodies did not turn up until years later after they disappeared. Here are some of the prosecutor's key points during closing arguments.
Because we've been here for 5 months, I want to walk us back through the facts, a little bit, actually in a lot of detail, to remind you of things that are important, but also to make those connections for you, to understand the significance and an interpretation of them that point towards the defendant being a willful, deliberate killer. It was blow after blow after blow to a child's skull, a three-year-old and a four-year-old. That is an intentional killing. We heard from Michael and Susan that Joseph was running Earth-Inspired Products, a water feature company. But more importantly, we understood that this was a bifurcated business with internet sales. I think Mike called them drop and ship sales that came in through the internet website that was optimized by Dan Kavanaugh, really run by Dan Kavanaugh. And you actually saw evidence in this case, even through the defense case, that Dan Kavanaugh continued to run that business even after the murder of the McStays, with shipments to Adagio and other water feature companies. But then you had the other side, which was the custom orders. These are bigger, more complex, custom-built and designed waterfalls. You also learned that the defendant was being sidelined. And there were several pieces of operative evidence that you may not have connected those dots to understand it as the defendant being sidelined. One is there were project failures. Pervecho, Levine. You heard from David Cicada about having to make up work because the defendant wasn't doing it, or he was doing a sloppy job, or he was nowhere to be found. Joseph was looking for other fabricators and welders type people to do the work.
The prosecution said the motive was money and pointed to the defendant's DNA on the gear shift, steering wheel, and radio of the victim's vehicle, but not on the door handles or anywhere else. The defendant says it got there because he had lunch with Joseph McStay the day the McStays disappeared, and he shook hands at the conclusion of the meal, right before Joseph got in the car. The defense came out fighting on all these issues and accused the prosecutor of flat-out lying to the jury.
They had nobody set up to replace him because he wasn't getting replaced. The only person that could do that work was him. And they had nobody left. Now, the phone record, the two exhibits I showed up here, Joseph's on the left, Merritt's is on the right. This is Agent Bowles talking about how they both came and they're both in the same area for hours. Because there's Foothill, there's Foothill. There's Milliken, there's Milliken. There's Day Creek, there's Day Creek. The phones are all pinging because they're at that restaurant right there. They talked about that on direct. And now they're saying there's no evidence that they actually met. Do you like being lied to? When I'm giving you my closing, I'm standing before you and facing you the whole time. I am not giving you the closing like this because it's easier to lie when my back's to you.
That is a tough accusation. Look, the jury in this case can consider first-degree murder, second-degree murder, or not guilty. Those are the charges on the table. Let's turn to the panel one more time on this one. Judge Ashley Wilcott, has the judge kept control in this case? Why or why not?
No, I do not think the judge has kept control at all. The first is just logistics. It's been many, many months of ongoing trial, lots of breaks for different valid reasons, but also I think it could have been more efficiently done. The result of that is the jury has to have a lot of information and evidence before them over a long period of time that they actually have to recall and sift through, which is going to make their job more challenging.
Okay, so the mechanics are a mess, and then you've got the attorneys just duking it out right up to the end here, accusing one another of lying. Of course, attorneys aren't supposed to do that. Linda Kenny Bodden, what did you make of that charge that the defense dropped during closings?
Well, they're trying to give the death penalty to their clients. So, I mean, this has been a hard-fought case. I mean, it's true. I mean, there's also the hard-fought on other things, Aaron, when it comes to the DNA and the Isuzu you just mentioned. It was one swab that took the DNA. It could have been on one place, and then just not on the other two places. It was sloppy from the beginning, and the McStay family didn't deserve it.
Okay, you know, DNA can travel a lot of different places, Judge Wilcott. You know, I touch the desk, then Linda touches the desk, then she's got it on her. My DNA winds up on her phone, even though I didn't even touch her phone. The phone's sitting there, the phone's on the desk, etc., etc., etc. Bottom line, the state's really trying to go for the death penalty here. Do they have enough evidence?
I don't think they do, or more importantly, I think that they've got a little bit of reasonable doubt in that evidence. There's not a lot of DNA evidence. It's in the vehicle. Like you said, that type of transference is very easy. It can happen easily. So I think it's very hard for the state to connect the dots to prove beyond a reasonable doubt this is the right defendant.
Linda Kenny Button, we've got unknown DNA in the graves. Whose DNA is it?
We don't know, and that's the problem. And it's around the rope, if I recall, and that's a problem. I mean, there should be, for this type of killing, some DNA somewhere, but the only DNA we don't have is that of the person on trial.
These people were brutalized. It's a horrible crime. The prosecutor hinging on emotion, the defense saying, you're not supposed to do that. We're waiting for closing arguments to roll along in this case. Linda Kenny Bodden, Judge Ashley Wilcott, appreciate your input as always on The Debrief.
Thanks, Aaron.
We want to thank those of you for watching along with us. If you're watching on the Law and Crime Network, our live trial coverage will continue in just a moment. We have several cases live as we speak. For those of you watching elsewhere, we will see you tomorrow on The Debrief. Thanks for joining us again.